Welcome to What is Going Om for New Thought from the Edge of Om. Each week on Om Time's flagship radio show, veteran broadcaster, author, and media consultant Sandy Sedgebeer conducts thought-provoking interviews with inspirational authors, artists, musicians, scientists, speakers, and filmmakers who are working at the point where spirituality and science meet consciousness at the very edge of Om. Here is your host, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello. We're living in unprecedented times, with climate deniers occupying the highest levels of government and the US pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords, and with species rapidly disappearing, global temperatures rising, and a growing urgency to do something meaningful, to act on the ecological crisis we face. Well, two key questions are arising. How can we stay sane in the face of such blatant denial? And how can we take wise action? Stephanie Kaza is Professor Emerita of Environmental Studies at the University of Vermont, a leading Buddhist environmentalist. She's the author of Mindfully Green, A Personal and Spiritual Guide to Whole Earth Thinking, Conversations with Trees and Intimate Ecology. She's the editor of Hooked, Buddhist Writings on Greed, Desire and the Urge to Consume, and co-editor with Kenneth Craft of Dharma Rain, Sources of Buddhist Environmentalism. Stephanie Kaza joins me today to talk about her latest book, Green Buddhism, Practice and Compassionate Action in Uncertain Times, which offers guidance on how Buddhists can be a critical voice in the green conversation. Stephanie Kaza, welcome.
Thank you so much, Sandy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Stephanie, in your introduction to Green Buddhism, you write that when you began your studies at college, you thought you would concentrate on the sciences with a view to possibly becoming a surgeon. What happened to change that trajectory?
Well, my original thought was I was so moved by the beauty of the human body, the complexity, the amazing chemistry and sensitivity of the human body, and I wanted to be a healer. And I think I've taken the healing urge to a larger scale to the environment.
I'll say. And, to the entire world.
I fell in love with much more than the human body, to see that gorgeous complexity in every life form, from a small amoeba to a huge sequoia redwood.
So how did that inspire you to become a Buddhist?
Well, I was enjoying being outdoors quite a bit, doing a lot of hiking and river rafting and camping, and I really felt a deep sense of spiritual connection to nature, and I was looking for some religion that would support that. And it just turned out that the basic principle of interdependence and a sense of connection with all of life was right in the center of Buddhism. So that's what pulled me towards it.
Now, as I mentioned in my introduction, you're Professor Emerita of Environmental Studies at the University of Vermont. You're an environmentalist, a Buddhist, a writer and author, and a lot more besides. And yet the very first phrase that you use in your description of yourself on your website is a lover of trees. Does that trump it all?
Well, that's a tremendous source of deep love and gratitude. And I just, in fact, returned from a pilgrimage to our most beloved trees, the bristlecone pines in the eastern part of California. And these trees live to be 4,000 years old. So you bow down before these tree elders. They carry a lot of wisdom through that much lifetime of experience.
You know, reading your book, I read a lot of books for this show, and this one, it really churned me in a way I don't think I've ever been churned before, not just because the enormity of what is happening to our planet, you know, it was there staring me in the face, but also because there's so much in your book that I wanted to talk about, and I'm thinking, I just don't know where to start. Where to begin? And then I got to, I think it was chapter 12 on ethics, and I thought, okay, you know, this is the place, I have to really dive into this with you because it is so fundamental. I mean, to me, ethics underlies all of it. Before we start talking about ethics, let's look at, you know, the first part of your book where you talk about intimate relations and the intimacy of non-dualism. Speak a little bit about that.
Well, very often in all different kinds of religious traditions, from shamanism to Catholicism to Judaism to Islam, there is an experience at the heart of the religious experience that's often described as being at one with, or a oneness, either with a god or with some nature spirits, but some bigger sense of awe that goes beyond the human. Now, the kind of intimacy that I talk about in Buddhism that goes under this name non-dualistic is an intimacy with that oneness, but also with a sense of two-ness, that here's this tree or spider, another being that's completely different than you as a human being, and in acknowledging that difference at the same time as acknowledging the connection makes that spiritual experience even deeper. It's quite profound to both sense that you're in the same universe, but you're living completely different experienced lives.
Well, you know, the book is so thought-provoking. Talking about non-dualism, talking about stereotyping, you know, I was thinking about, you know, we love trees, and you were saying how easy it is for us to talk about nice things, you know, deers and rabbits and songbirds, and then we call the other things spiders and snakes and bats and things like nasty, mean. We separate ourselves from them, and yet there is no separation from anything. You know, if we can't separate ourselves from deers and rabbits, we certainly can't separate ourselves from the spiders and the snakes.
Yes, this is one of the practices that I picked up from Buddhist study that's really profoundly helpful in the natural world, that you no picking or choosing. Be present with all things that are there, some of which you think you'll like and some of which you think you won't like. But the training, the Buddhist training, is not to turn away, not to go towards something in terms of greed, or turn away from it, an aversion, or to just make up stories about it on your own, a kind of delusion. Those three are seen as the three poisons that cloud your clear thinking. So a lot of training is about learning to recognize that greed, aversion, and delusion in all its different forms. And as you say, we have many, many conditioned ideas about parts of the natural world that get in our way for seeing what it really is.
Well, yeah, as you say, I mean, the inclusion part, it really made a big impact on me, because it made me stop and think about the way I think and the way that I've been conditioned. And so it was a rather challenging book to read, because it made me squirm in places. It really brought home to me, you know, I need to be looking at myself and my own dualistic thinking. You write also about feminism and how that's exposed a particular aspect of conditioned thinking that is generally overlooked in Buddhism. And you write quite a bit about feminism and Buddhism. Would you like to say a little bit about that?
Well, that essay was a request in the early 90s. I, of course, subsequently worked on it a little bit more. But Buddhism, like many religions, has inherited a lot of patriarchal social forms and social conditioning, and a sense that, you know, the men will become the priests, or certain male intellectual streams are the ones that will dominate. And a wonderful thing happened when Buddhism came to the West, very much in the 1960s, and then just grew and grew. So it's quite prominent now across the country. Even though the numbers are small, there's a Buddhist center in most cities, large cities, and certainly medium-sized cities. But it came at the time that feminism and environmentalism were both very much in public consciousness and dialogue. So I just sort of ran with that. I had read quite a bit of ecofeminism, and there was a lot of very strong intellectual critique and clarification and development going on. But nobody was looking at the intersection really with Buddhism. There was some looking with Christianity, and there's some very creative feminist theology out there. But Buddhism was sort of running behind the times. So I brought my own ecological version of this and tried to find where do these streams intersect, because it's not like there's a nonprofit somewhere made up of environmental feminist Buddhists.
Right.
But it did seem to me that feminists offered some wonderful insights that corrected some of the more patriarchal or non-feminist aspects of Buddhism, and at the same time help to expose some of our conditioned thinking about the natural world, which, you know, isn't really anybody's fault. I certainly don't want you to feel bad about some of the cultural stereotypes that you grew up with, because we were taught them in books, and they're in our movies and television scripts, and people repeat them all the time. So, of course, we all tend to think the same way about some of these things in the natural world.
Mm-hmm. But it is very, you know, a very powerful reminder. You know, it made me think, you know, having the word Buddhism in the title, is that limiting the book? Because I'm not a Buddhist, but boy, did I respond to your book. And I might not have picked it up otherwise.
Well, you know, that's a marketing question for the publisher. So yeah. I had to turn to them. When you put a book together, they both want to grab an audience that might not have known the book was there. And there are very few books, really, in this stream of religious thought. There are many more Christian ecological books, and, again, not so many Muslim books, a little bit more Judaism. But Buddhism is still pretty small. There's only a few of us that have been writing in this area. So I think we worked with a subtitle, which I hope would catch other people, Practice and Compassionate Action in Uncertain Times, because I very much do feel that interfaith dialogue and talking about this from any useful perspective is really the call of our times.
Well, it occurred to me several times that really I wanted to expand it, because every time I read something about, you know, what can Buddhism bring to this, it was, well, what can I learn from Buddhism, you know, that I can also bring to this? So, it's interesting. And the fact that these are a number of essays that you've written, and clearly, you know, each essay in itself, which is complete in itself, it reveals such deep contemplative thinking about these issues. And I wonder, you know, did you find it hard deciding what to put in or what to leave out of the book?
Well, definitely the editorial process is very engaging, and I had written many more pieces besides this, and they had to find a certain congruence and a certain pacing. And there were a number of chapters that I cut down or I updated. I wanted it to feel as if all this thought was still very current and very important and very relevant. So that was my goal in editing the book. And of course, I had help from editors at Shambhala. It's wonderful to work with a good editor and get their feedback. So the three sections really ended up determining what went in the book. And I wanted to begin with this intimacy, because that's really my life experience. Well, that's where I start from, even before Buddhism. Just being with nature, being with the natural world and all of its various members, whether it's in the garden or out on a hike or just walking in your city streets. So that seemed the most important thing. And I particularly enjoyed writing the piece about tea mind, earth mind, because of our beautiful Japanese garden here in Portland, Oregon, which I go to all the time, and very intimate place. So beginning there and then going on to, well, so what does green Buddhism have to offer, trying to give people who want that history, that's there, and the ethics chapter especially. And then action. How do we take action? So it seemed to build naturally from experience in the natural world that is motivating and transforming, and then on to how do you think about it? How do you put all this together? And then, so what? What will you do now? So that basic trajectory can happen whether it's in a religious context or any kind of spiritual context, for really anybody.
You know, I don't think I have ever made so many notes and copied so many, you know, whole chunks of what you'd written to give me further thought of how I could condense that down to frame a question, because there was just so much in there that I wanted to highlight, and, you know, one can't cover it all. So I think, you know, when we come back from the break that we'll be going to shortly, I would like to focus on ethics, because I think there are many, many people right now that are saying this is the underlying problem that we have on this planet right now, is, you know, what has happened to our ethics. So we'll come back to that in a moment. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'm speaking with Professor Emerita of Environmental Studies at the University of Vermont, Stephanie Kaza. And we're talking about her new book, Green Buddhism, which offers guidance on how Buddhists and the rest of us can be a critical voice in the green conversation. We'll be back with more after the break.
The future of internet radio is here. OM Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose: to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free. AscendingHearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called the Bukavu in the Congo. We were a loving family, and then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day. People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything. I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at EmbraceRefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Stephanie Kaza, let's talk about part two of your book, Envisioning Green Buddhism, and specifically, ethics matter. So where would you like to start with this? Because it truly is such a big topic.
Well, let me tell a little story about where that all those thoughts came from. In early, mid-2000s, I think it was around 2007, Shambhala asked me, could you please write a book that would have a more contemplative foundation than the usual 50 things you can do to save the environment? Because those books were coming out one after another, and they made it sound so simple. And Shambhala, as a spiritual psychological press, wanted more depth. So at that point, I started thinking about these different contemplative principles. And what really sharpened my thinking was that my mother passed away in 2007. So I took a kind of retreat. It was a very, of course, powerful experience. And I just concentrated on this book and really thought about it and came up with these three areas that could help simplify the way you thought about the commitments and the dedication you took. It just seemed to fall into place really quite quickly. And what really dawned on me was this idea of a green practice path. So I took this idea and I tested it after it came out as a book, and took it to the Thomas Merton Center, which is a Catholic center supporting Thomas Merton's contemplative life, and gave it in the form of a keynote address in an interfaith setting. And then I knew that these ideas really could hold up because they resonated so strongly for people of other religious backgrounds. So this green practice path is about a path you can step on and just keep trying, even though, you know, you'll make mistakes and things will be easier and harder on different days. But it's a commitment to just kind of keep trying. And I could see, using the Catholic model, that there's a kind of beginner's mind when you first get excited about this sort of approach, and then a more developed state, which I used this Catholic term, the novice, where you've made a commitment, but you still are learning a lot. And then if you really take this to the farthest depths, you're just living and breathing the green practice path all the time. It's part of everything you do. So it's a kind of trajectory you can step on at any point and pick up any of these contemplative principles to just try to work with one of them at a time and see, how can I reduce harm? How can I be with the suffering right in front of me? How can I embrace and act from a deep view? So this green practice path can really provide a container for an orientation in everyday life. And sometimes people respond well to something that you can hold on to rather than feeling overwhelmed by all that looks so impossible and undoable. And it quickly, you know, stops you in your tracks.
It certainly does. I want to just read a little piece that I copied that really spoke to me. You wrote, "The impact of human activity on the natural world has been well documented by many observers across many regions of the earth. Soil erosion, species decimation, habitat destruction, water depletion. There's no shortage of evidence for the powerful nature of greed. In some cases, greed is driven by profit motivation, in others by hunger. Environmentalists have made careers out of documenting the scale of its impact and fighting this biological drive run amok. Most of the time, they point their fingers at others, associating greed with capitalism or economic globalization." And we all do that. But as you say, what about other forms of greed? There are many forms of greed that we don't even think about. Most of us would say, no, I'm not a greedy person. You know, I don't consume too much. But tell us about some of the other forms of greed that, you know, we could contemplate.
Well, there's a nice chapter in the book where I forced myself to do exactly that exercise and be really honest. And I realized I, as a professor and a learner of and a great love of knowledge, had a greed for knowledge. And I have quite a collection of books. When people come into our house, they remark on the bookshelves. And that's one place my greed is expressed. And I've rationalized it, of course, as a teacher,
yes,
that I would share these with others and so on. But I especially, even though I'm not teaching as much right now, I love collecting natural history field guides. And so then I have books on geology and birds and mushrooms and so on. So that's one kind of greed that looks very positive. It's just that greed in a more traditional religious sense is seen as a sin. And from a Buddhist sense, it's just seen as something to look at and try to understand.
Yeah.
It's the drive towards something you want more of. So that could be money and profits as in, you know, corporate, say, development of fossil fuels. But it could also be status and clout. Mm-hmm. Or more members in your environmental group. You just think if you had more people and were more well-recognized, then everyone would believe you. Sometimes it's for scientific data. That's often been true in environmental work. You think if you have the numbers and you can show people that there's more carbon in the atmosphere, that they'll automatically respond and do something. Of course, it turns out that's not always true. So just to understand how greed pulls us towards those things we like and want more of, whether it's, you know, good coffee or good friends, to watch how it works, because the opposite is what we're pushed away from. And
yes,
to feel that as a biological and social organism, it develops great self-awareness. Doesn't mean you stop feeling greed. It's a quite natural thing. After our very cold camping trip, I had quite a lot of greed feeling for a hot shower.
Absolutely, yeah. It really does make you think about it in a different way. I mean, you say that, you know, the Buddhist psychology explains greed in simple terms of attraction and aversion. And in Buddhist terms, all emotions can be boiled down to three fundamental tendencies: wanting more of something, greed, or we might call it passion, wanting less of something, hate, and wanting something that doesn't exist, delusion. So, you know, talk about where wanting less of something becomes hate and delusion as well.
Yes, wanting less of something, people can work up quite a head of steam around trying to get rid of the bad people or develop very strong ethics around, you know, what you are eating is wrong, what I am eating is right. I imagine the vegans of the world would really prefer there be no more omnivores just because of all their rationalizations for choosing vegan eating practices. So what happens when we take up a kind of aversion stance is it's quite easy to become self-righteous and decide that your ethics are the best ethics.
Yes.
And this is a real kind of typical character flaw among environmentalists, I have to say, with a little bit of laughter, because it's in the urge to correct things and to make the world better, they can make a quite black and white distinction between something they think is the right way and the not the other way. So that's a very ugly manifestation of aversion. And I think one of the Buddhist contributions is to downplay that and encourage all voices to participate and never to lock in on one way as the only right way. Now, the delusion, I'll just say something about that, because we're in the middle of such a climate crisis, and delusion is being actively manufactured and reinforced and amplified throughout the world, as you said, by people in authority, positions of authority, but also by people that are just afraid, people who don't want to think about the kind of change that might shake up everything in their towns and communities and families. It's not an easy thing to look at, and I think it's important to have compassion for the human psyche that doesn't want that scale of disruption. It's very scary. And when you look at those floods and hurricanes on TV, you don't laugh, you know. These people are losing everything. So to stay in a world of delusion is kind of comfortable and safe feeling. It's the pull the covers over your head feeling. You know, and some days you do kind of need that just to take a break. But ultimately, to look at it is going to deepen awareness and capacity to just see, right now, this is what's going on for me and for others. So those three, working with those three is a really important piece of this green practice path.
Absolutely. And this is where we see what we can learn from Buddhism and Buddhism's approach here, because I don't know that I would have thought about these things in the same way if you hadn't detailed them so well in the book. Passion. We call it passion. and often it is greed.
Well, you know, a Western psychology has many complicated emotional responses that are described there, you know, despair, rage, frustration. There's a long list, and we are pretty well trained, those of us interested in emotional literacy, to use those kinds of vocabularies. So for me, the Buddhist psychology simplifies things, making it a little easier to study personally.
Yes.
And then it allows you to make ethical choices out of those three principles. So, for example, reducing harm, that's the very first principle, ahimsa, in the Buddhist precepts. And you could see that you might be harming yourself with one of these greed patterns. So if you want to reduce harm, then it might mean you choose, less alcohol, or maybe you're not digesting meat so well. You might choose something to do with your diet, or perhaps with your transportation choices, or with your social relations. Maybe you need more green practice friends to support your choices. So reducing harm is a never-ending field of opportunity, particularly in our very consumerist, materialist world.
Yeah, I'm talking about consumerism. You taught classes on unlearning consumerism. How do we unlearn it?
Oh, that was so much fun. It was one of my favorite classes, and I based it on a class that I'd heard about called Unlearning Racism. And I had the sense that our understanding of race was so powerfully influenced by social forces that it was probably somewhat parallel in consumerism. So we tried to do a certain amount of deconstruction, but I based it all in experiential learning. And every week the students had some little task they had to do, like measure their energy use. But the very first exercise sort of put the whole course in relief. I asked the students to make a list of every single thing they owned. They had to list all their hiking and skiing and snowboarding equipment. They had to list all their clothes, their underwear, their t-shirts, their prom dresses, their wigs. They had to list their toiletry. I said, don't forget the kitchen and the bathroom. Well, by the time they listed all those things and then wrote a very short little reflective essay, their minds were quite opened to how much stuff they had and how oriented to stuff they were. So we had a wonderful, wide-reaching, open-ended conversation, but the key to it was being non-judgmental. And that's where I kind of brought my Buddhist background into the classroom so the students would know it wasn't right or wrong, what they had or didn't have. I wasn't going to jump on them. I wasn't going to allow them to jump on each other either, because it was just to look, just to see how deeply shaped we are by brand names, by wanting to own something, wanting to participate in a certain activity and get all that stuff. So my eyes were opened as well. I didn't say too much, but it was interesting what they did own. And I appreciated most of all their honesty.
Honestly,
that's where we could start.
No better way, than to lay it right in front of us and get us thinking about that, because you can just see, I can just imagine people's eyes opening wider and wider and going, ooh, oh, oops, as they suddenly,
The students, it worked really well with undergraduates because actually they don't own that much yet. It's all in one room, their, residential hall room. When I've done this with adults, I have to restrict them to one room. I say, this will be too overwhelming. So pick your bedroom or the kitchen or the living room and just list everything in that one room. It has the same effect.
It does. So now that lovely section on obstacles on the path. Let's talk about some of the obstacles. I mean, things like anger, frustration, impotence, all of these things that get in our way of us being able to actually be useful.
Well, we're human beings, aren't we? And these things are part of what makes us who we are. They just come up over and over every day. So part of what happens with the obstacles is that we protect ourselves. We don't want to feel certain feelings. We don't want to feel overwhelmed. We're not strong enough for really difficult mind states. It takes practice. It takes a focus and a commitment. And it does take something else I talk about in the book, spiritual friendship. I don't think you can do this green practice path alone. But in a hyper-individualistic society, like in the United States and much of the Western world, we are kind of taught that. We'll do it all ourselves, a kind of tough attitude. But these things are very difficult. We need friends. We need people that can help us when we get discouraged and get stuck on some of these obstacles. So I mentioned one possible exercise, but there are a number of them from this wonderful teacher, Joanna Macy. And I will say I've been working with her a lot in the last year on a new book with her, and we're quite excited. It's a book to honor her at age 90, who's been doing this work with obstacles for, 50 years. You start with where you are with whatever the pain is. Well, actually, you start from gratitude, being glad that you can do this work at all. But then, honestly, you acknowledge, I'm feeling despair, I'm depressed, I'm grieving over losing. Where are the birds that used to come to my yard? people feel these things very deeply and with a lot of sadness and anger, but they are still a powerful response to the world, and that's what is really where the energy is. If you feel that strong of an emotion, it gives you a place to work with that energy and let it transform by being honest with it. From there, you can shift out of that self-absorbed perspective of your emotional state into one that reflects your sense of relationship with the rest of life. And once you're in a state of relating with all other beings, there's so much more energy, such exciting energy coming from trees or from, you know, even your cat and dog in your house. Or currently I'm quite fascinated by mushrooms and fungi and how they have little root hairs scattered all across the earth and dirt and tying the whole world together. So that sense of being connected to all of it is a tremendous source of energy and joy in the face of overwhelming obstacles of difficult emotions.
And that's been brought home to us a lot in recent years with all the books that have emerged about trees and the way, you know, trees support one another, the kind of the community, the society that they have, the brotherhood in a sense, and the way that they work together, which has been a real eye-opener, I think, for many people. It's opened their minds to so many other ways in which we're connected that we cannot see.
Exactly. And we cannot see. It's really pays to have what some Buddhist teachers call don't know mind. Just take the attitude of humility that there is so much more we don't understand. And before we just chop it down or spray it with pesticide, to think twice about what else is going on here. What is the story behind this tree or these little flowers that just popped out that you never met before? To take a little bit of a precautionary stance. We could slow down just the rate of destruction quite a bit with just that first precautionary principle.
Yes, indeed. And it's time to go to break. You're listening to What Is Going On. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and my guest tonight is Stephanie Kaza, and we're talking about her book, Green Buddhism. We'll be back with more from Stephanie Kaza after the break.
The cutting edge of conscious radio, OM Times Radio, IOM FM. Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single OM Times endeavor. Host your show with OM Times Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Lisa Barry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
Imagine being fired because of who you love. Imagine being denied medical treatment because of who you marry. Imagine being evicted because of who you are. Millions of Americans don't have to imagine this. They have to live it. Because in 31 states, it's legal to discriminate against LGBT people. Get the facts at beyondido.org. Brought to you by the Gill Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. Stephanie Kaza, in 1993, you published a book called The Attentive Heart, Conversations with Trees, which recorded a series of your personal, sometimes spiritual, relationships with individual trees. That book has now been republished this year. And in the preface to the re-released version, you point out that, you know, many of the stories that you shared reflect the changing conditions for trees and forests throughout the West Coast of America owing to climate change. And you talk about, you know, how with climate change accelerating and national politics precarious and the future of the planet being at stake in such a frightening way, many people are feeling overwhelmed, despairing even at what is happening to the planet, and indeed to us too. In this context, you raise the question what the stories in Conversations with Trees offer us. How can it be different against the relentless destructive forces that seem to be taking the planet into a dark time? How are these stories helpful to us? Would you share with us your answer to that question? How can these stories about trees help us?
When I first wrote this book, I felt incredibly shy and maybe a little bit crazy to be putting these stories in this kind of form. And I was greatly encouraged by a teacher myself. I was in a seminary program for the Unitarian school of thought, and I even considered becoming a minister. In fact, right now I'm sitting in a minister's office in our local downtown Unitarian church. And this teacher encouraged me and said, you should keep going with these. And so my classmates and the teacher helped me get this to the form of a book. And then I was quite deeply encouraged by meeting a wonderful man at a meditation retreat just before I moved to Vermont, who turned out to be a very good artist. And I was really hoping we could convey something about the stories through the art. So he did these illustrations, and in the course of working on the book together, we fell in love and got married, and we just celebrated our 21st anniversary. So I didn't put all that in this new preface, but there is a joyfulness in this book that I think can offer a respite, a refuge for people. In a time of being overwhelmed, there's a hunger for taking a break from the pace of social media and internet and email, Instagram, everything that moves so fast. The hunger to slow down and think deeply is coming back to life in the midst of all the craziness. So this book is one island of refuge. And for people who have a little bit of a fellow feeling for trees, they'll find a fellow spiritual walker here. When I first the book first came out, people would come up to me after a reading and they'd say, well, you know, I have this maple tree in my backyard and I look at it every day and it really means a lot to me. But they were whispering. They weren't sure it was okay to talk about a tree like this, like it was a child or a pet or something. And I just encouraged them. And so that's how I think of this book now, is more encouragement, that whatever messages of love and care and complexity around trees and their stories we can spend time with, the stronger we'll be individually and the more we'll feel we have friends. Anyone reading this book will know they're not alone, that there is a swelling cry for caring for trees and doing it in a beautiful and organized and personal and intimate way. So the trees are just an example of deeper relationship with some other part of the natural world than just the human society. So I'm looking for hopefully better relations between humans and trees, but I'm also as interested in spiders and, you know, songbirds and the other beautiful things that really make our life so rich. So I hope that the book is a bit of a refuge and a encouragement to be listening to one's own soul in relationship to the other living members of our community here. It's much bigger than just our people.
Many people today, I mean, climate change you know, the whole topic, it's so ubiquitous we cannot escape it, and rightly so, we shouldn't. But here in England we have, you know, the Climate Extinction Group doing all kinds of things that are really upsetting other people because it's interfering with their daily life. We have Youth for Climate Action. We've got Greta Thunberg, you know, who's doing an amazing job drawing attention to how the youth of today feel about it. But there are many, many people who want to do something, they may not necessarily have the time, the money, or, you know, whatever else, or even the skills, you know, to do something big. But I'm sure there are many small things that we can all do. What would you recommend for somebody who says, well, I don't know where to start?
I get that question a lot, and I really love it, because just even asking the question means something is opening inside that wants to respond. So I say stay with that. The fact that you want to respond will lead you to something that makes sense for you to do. It doesn't have to be a prescription, but staying open is the most important part. So what I often say is just talk about it. Even if you can't think of a thing to do yet, if you can talk about the news, you know, the Greta Thunberg talk, pass that on to a bunch of friends or bring it up at a family dinner. If you can talk about the Extinction Rebellion tactics, even if you don't like it or you're not sure what you think, you're still talking about it. So talking about climate is the most important thing we can do right now, because the world conversation is swelling so quickly. You know, this is only really maybe a 10-year-old movement. Our big guy over here, Bill McKibben, who founded 350.org, he was a colleague of mine in Vermont. And back in the early 2000s, he thought, well, why don't we just have a climate march? It'll be small. It's Vermont, but let's just do it. So he led this little group from Middlebury up to Burlington. And when we got to Burlington, which was where my university was, we had all the local politicians come and sign a little statement, I will pay attention to climate change. Well, it wasn't very many people. We thought it was huge with about 1,000 people. Now look at where things are. Millions marched a couple of weeks ago for the climate strike. So anybody in any position can just talk about it and say, I heard on the news. Or, you know, the local bus company is now running that bus every 15 minutes. Maybe I'll try that. Or Meatless Mondays. What is that? I just heard about Meatless Mondays. Maybe I'll try that. I think it's the combined small efforts that will help. But honestly, climate change won't really be turned around by individual efforts like this. And that's a hard thing to recognize. But ultimately, it's going to mean laws and regulation and big scale changes, big business incentives, big shifts in energy infrastructure. And those are things that we can't do as individuals. That really requires a much bigger scale of effort. But we can encourage those choices where they're happening. So if your local power company is trying to change their mix from coal or more polluting forms of energy to greener forms, you can support them. You can say, way to go, that's going to be good. Not something you can do on your own. So I'm really big on talking about it. And even my own little Buddhist sitting group now is talking about climate change. And one of the people goes and sits on a corner downtown Portland and says, want to talk about climate change? Talk to me. So I think that's a really good place to start. As far as specifics, it is true that eating meat is one of the larger energy consumers on the planet. So if you cut down your meat and eat more vegetables, you're likely to have made a little bit of difference in carbon emissions. But that's also true about transportation. Transportation choices are one of the most important you can make right now. About a third of the carbon emissions come from transportation. So just choosing how many cars you own, how many miles you drive, how you get around, do you ride a bicycle, can you walk? all those things, those will help make a difference and will support the cities who are way ahead on making some of these transportation changes, which is very exciting, the bike paths and the electric vehicles and buses and so on. So I think the things to do are all around us, but staying close to the heart is very important here, staying open to the difficulty, to the call for compassionate response, and just being willing, just to cultivate that. That's what I tell people.
You know, going back to the non-dualistic thinking that we discussed at the beginning, it is a lot easier, I think, for people to grasp that, you know, an animal or a tree is not separate from us, and maybe change the way that they may relate to something that they didn't like before, like spiders, for example, which used to horrify me when I was a child. And now, you know, I don't ever want to see a spider harmed. I don't want it in my bedroom, but I don't want to see it harmed, so it has to be put outside very carefully. But when it comes to other human beings, especially human beings that aren't behaving in a very nice way, it's much harder to, you know, apply this non-dualistic thinking. And many people are getting very angry. They're getting very angry with the US government. They're getting angry with, you know, the fossil fuel companies. They're getting angry with anybody who is against or they believe is contributing to the problem. What can we learn from Buddhism about cultivating compassion in those circumstances?
You've really identified something that's so important now, this kind of divisive, free-flowing anger and rage. It's so harmful to human relations, and it makes it so much more difficult to do the things we need to do to take care of the planet so we can continue to live here. So some place to start with compassion is cultivating equanimity, a sense of stability. Anywhere that's already somewhat stable is a really important island for that cultivation of compassion. So that may be your own home where you know that things operate well. You can have three meals a day. It's warm. The bills are paid. You're kind to your partner. That kind of equanimity and stability is really important in a society where people are throwing a lot of tough things at each other. So that's one aspect of this, and that's seen as one of the highest Buddhist virtues, equanimity. It's seen as a way of offering love to the world without being too flamboyant about it, just staying very steady. The compassionate side means trying to find that horrible behavior inside yourself, understanding that it has a root cause, that it is exists in all human beings, and you may be choosing not to act on it, but somebody else is feeling something very similar and acting on it. So rather than separating and isolating and condemning, understanding that we're all made up of the same biological urges, and some people are under more pressure than others and less able to restrain those impulses. So cultivating equanimity provides a kind of buffer zone, some margin for that acting out. And it can be a very proactive thing to do, to say, no, we will eat meals at the same time every day, or we will act this way in our household or at community meetings or in the workplace. So I think of a Buddhist green practice path as being a little island of safety, even if it's difficult, but a place that helps others relax, that you're always thinking that it's a way of serving other people so that we all have a better chance at living successfully on this much more fragile planet than we realize.
You know, I had to smile when I saw your website. It really touched me that beyond everything, you put, you know, a lover of trees first. If you had to distill everything you've accomplished in your life, the things you've learned, experienced, taught, all the appellations that have been applied to you, how would you most want to be remembered? Would that phrase, lover of trees, be the thing that would remain at the top of the list?
You know, it just might. I've already figured out the tree that means the most to me, where I would like to have my ashes placed. So I think the lover of trees is a code way of saying lover of life. Yes. And lover of all forms of miracle, from the beautiful constellations in the sky to the changing phases of the moon to the cycles of life across the year and all the beings, human, plant, fungi, and otherwise, that inhabit this miraculous planet.
Well, I have to tell you that, you know, as I said before, reading your book, it was kind of blowing my mind a bit, because it was touching me on so many levels, and I didn't know where I would even begin, because there was so much I wanted to talk about, and you can't cram it all into an hour. But for me, and I was also looking at where can I begin within myself, you know, to begin to practice some of this. But for me, what settled everything was that phrase, lover of trees, because I thought right there is a place to begin, because when you learn about trees and when you really understand about our connection to all beings, that's the funnel in, you know. You know, once you understand that, everything else falls into place.
You know, I do talk about green wisdom sources, and of course trees are one of the big ones for me. And there you are in the UK, where there's a long, long centuries-old tradition of trees as a green wisdom source.
Yes.
So when your own culture offers that up, it makes it an easy place to go for green wisdom. So there are many stunningly majestic and amazing trees, well, really, in every neck of the woods.
Everywhere.
But
yeah.
I encourage everyone to go out and meet a new tree.
Meet a new tree. Stephanie Carter, thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for this book.
You're most welcome. It's really been a delight.
Green Buddhism by Stephanie Carter is published by Shambhala Publications, Inc. And for more information on Stephanie Carter and her work, visit Stephanie Carter, K-A-Z-A or Z-A, .com. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. Thanks for joining me today, and I look forward to being with you at the same time next week. Till then, it's goodbye from me.